Farah Hughes from Belfast, political activist. And for the little time we had, Hossein Boukhaiti from Sana, we do appreciate it, activist and political commentator. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks so much for tuning in. It's goodbye from me and the team from the capital, Tehran. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Iran says the link between acts of violence against its diplomatic missions in Europe and the West's support for rioters in the country is undeniable. North Korea warns that the U.S. deployment or redeployment of a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier near the Korean Peninsula is aggravating tensions in the region. Also, Israeli forces killed 2 Palestinian teenagers in the West Bank. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed by Israel in the occupied territories this year. Thank you for joining us. Iran has summoned the Danish ambassador over an attack by a knife-wielding assailant on the Iranian embassy in Copenhagen. The foreign ministry says it lodges strong protests with the ambassador over Denmark's failure to protect the embassy and its diplomats. Meanwhile, foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani has cited the attack and other incidents at Iranian diplomatic missions in Europe over the past weeks. He says the link between such acts of violence and the West's political support for rioters in Iran is undeniable. On Friday morning, an assailant broke into the Iranian embassy in Copenhagen. He tried to stop the ambassador, but he was stopped by a staffer. The assailant injured the staffer and damaged vehicles in a parking lot before being arrested by the Danish police. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman has called unacceptable a resolution passed by the European Parliament over the recent unrest in the country. Nasser Kanani said the resolution bears no value as it amounts to interfering in Iran's internal affairs. He accused the European Parliament of adopting a double standard approach, saying its resolution bodes well for prejudgments toward Iran. The resolution called for EU sanctions against Iranian officials over alleged human rights violations and crackdown against protests. The demonstrations broke out in a number of Iranian cities in mid-September after the death of a young woman, Mahsa Amini. The rallies then turned into riots, which Iran blamed on foreign elements. On Friday, Iran released an official forensic report into Amini's death. It said she died due to multiple organ failure caused by cerebral hypoxia, not beatings. Earlier, we were joined by Kevin Barrett, the editor of Veterans Today, to get his thoughts on the European Parliament's resolution against Iran. Take a listen.
They have been at loggerheads with Iran for half a century almost. And so whenever there's any chance to try to defame the Islamic Republic of Iran, they will take it. And other countries, if these countries choose to be vassal states of the American empire, to cozy up to Israel and to essentially do what the managers of empire want them to do, then they have carte blanche, at least up to a certain point, to engage in all kinds of atrocious behavior. The human rights situation in Saudi Arabia, for example, compared to in Iran, it's night and day. We have an autocratic thug running Saudi Arabia. I could go on all day talking about the brutal executions, the crackdowns, mistreatment, and the extreme level of autocracy that goes on there. But in Iran, where you actually have a democratic republic and the world's first democratic republic with an Islamic basis, an element of theocracy, that is suddenly a country that's going to be criticized and indeed targeted.
Tensions ratcheting up on the Korean Peninsula. North Korea warns that the U.S. redeployment of its nuclear-powered warship is aggravating regional security. The warning came a day after USS Ronald Reagan Strike Group began a new round of drills with South Korean ships off the country's east coast. North Korea called the event a huge negative splash in regional security, saying it's seriously monitoring the worrisome development. Pyongyang also defended its missile tests as a righteous action against direct U.S. military threats. A North Korean aviation official says the launches have caused no harm to neighbors or the region. North Korea has test-fired 6 missiles over the past 2 weeks. The U.S. held separate military drills with South Korea and Japan in response to the launches. Pyongyang considers those maneuvers as rehearsals for an invasion. Frank Smith says back-to-back missile tests, that is, and a flurry of muscle flexing near the Korean Peninsula, risk accidents there.
Well, in response to North Korea's missile launches, South Korea and the U.S. launched their own missiles, including one South Korean missile that landed back on its military base, causing a fire there. This really demonstrates the risk of this escalating testing and sort of military provocations on both sides of the DMZ, the border between North Korea and South Korea. And that risk, imagine if that missile had fell in North Korea, or if, again, another test takes place in which an inadvertent accident takes place and an escalation of a potential conflict could take place. So, again, we see these more testing, also flights. The South Korean and U.S. Air Forces conducted drills in the air following this testing. And so this really demonstrates the kind of tension on the Korean Peninsula between North Korea, the U.S., and South Korea, and to a lesser extent, Japan, which also participated in military exercises, maritime military exercises, with the U.S. and South Korea.
Israeli forces have killed 2 Palestinian teenagers in the occupied West Bank. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent Indra Maloh Monokandil to get more details about the killings. Stick a listen.
The Israeli soldiers have killed 2 Palestinian teens in separate incidents. The first one, 14-year-old Adel Dawood, was shot dead by the Israeli soldiers. The Israelis claim that Palestinians were holding a protest against the seizure of Palestinian land in Qalqilia. And then Palestinians went to protest near the Israeli separation wall, where Israeli military checkpoint is there as well. And the clashes have taken place there. And the Israeli forces opened fire towards Palestinians, killing this 14-year-old Palestinian teenager. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, near Ramallah in Al-Mazra'a Al-Gharbiya town, Palestinians have protested and rushed to the streets of this village, Al-Mazra al-Gharbiya, in order to face an attack by Israeli settlers. Group of Israeli settlers have raided Al-Mazra al-Gharbiya town, and they were throwing the stones against a Palestinian house there. Of course, as usual, the Israeli soldiers were protecting the Israeli settlers. They opened fire at the Palestinians, wounding at least one, wounding at least two. When the Palestinians were transferred to hospital, one of them, 17-year-old Mahdi Ladadwi, succumbed to his injuries. The Palestinian presidency and the Palestinian authority and the different Palestinian political and Islamic powers have denounced the killing of those two Palestinian teens and said that the Palestinians will continue to resist the Israeli forces and the Israeli military because this is a natural response, resistance and struggle to the ongoing and non-stop crimes being committed by the Israeli soldiers.
A mass rally has been held in the Gaza Strip to mark the 35th anniversary of the establishment of the Islamic Jihad movement, the movement that refuses to recognize the Israeli regime while maintaining armed resistance as the only way to liberate Palestine. Ashraf Shannon reports.
Thousands of Palestinians have rallied in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the 35th anniversary of the outset of the Islamic Jihad movement. People from all walks of life joined to show their support. The Islamic Jihad movement is highly respected by all Palestinian factions and has always been a uniting factor among them. The movement was founded by the late Dr. Fathi Shaqaqi, who was inspired by the Iranian Revolution and the teachings of the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini.
Today we pay tribute to our founder Fathi Shaqaqi and all the martyrs. Our path is a very long one and paved by the blood of martyrs who sacrificed their lives for the sake of Islam and for the sake of Al-Quds.
Ziad al-Nakhala, the Secretary General of Islamic Jihad, addressed the attendees via satellite link. During his speech, al-Nakhala stressed the unity among all Palestinian factions and praised the axis of resistance against the Israeli regime.
Gaza is part of the axis of resistance, and this rally stresses that armed resistance is the key to the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine. People attending this event are affirming their allegiance to the resistance and to the Islamic Jihad movement.
The Islamic Jihad movement and its leaders remain blacklisted by the European Union and the United States for refusing to recognize the Israeli regime.
We are all here to support the resistance against the Zionist regime. Our people are sending a strong message to the whole world today about their unwavering support for the resistance. We will continue our struggle until the liberation of Al-Quds.
Islamic Jihad supporters want the Israeli regime to know that their movement is a force to be reckoned with.
35 years on, the popularity of the Islamic Jihad movement continues to grow due to the movement's strict adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Europe is feeling the pinch of an acute energy crunch amid tensions with Russia over the war in Ukraine. The French president has now warned that the winter of 2023-2024 will be even harder than the coming winter for Europeans in terms of gas supplies. Emmanuel Macron says Europe will intensify talks with gas suppliers and coordinate with big Asian partner countries on gas purchases. He was speaking at a summit of European state leaders in the Czech Republic, where they are discussing a gas pricing system to protect their consumers from rising energy bills. The majority of EU states backed the cap on gas prices, but Denmark, Germany, and the Netherlands are opposed to the move. They say the measure would make it difficult to buy the gas their economies need and curb any incentive to reduce consumption. Homeless charities in the EU say they are at breaking point due to a spike in the number of people seeking support. A conference in Brussels fears the crisis is set to worsen this winter due to growing inflation and interest rates. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
Leading experts at this European Economic and Social Committee conference in Brussels on Friday said homelessness in the EU has increased by 70% in the past decade. A conservative estimate suggests there are 700,000 homeless people across the 27-country bloc.
We see now with the energy poverty and the increasing vulnerability that are happening around Europe that we are very, very concerned that those figures will also be increasing further. And that's why we believe that it's really important that we all join forces.
Young adults in precarious jobs are in one of the highest risk categories. If you have a mortgage, then repayments are going up due to interest rate hikes. If a landlord has a mortgage, they are passing on extra charges to tenants. Homeless people don't vote. So is there an incentive for politicians to take action?
If in such a short time so much can be done for Ukrainian refugees, and also if so much could be done for homeless people during the corona pandemic, I think we can do the same in the future. It's just a question of political will.
Those who have experienced being homeless say it's a very difficult situation to escape from.
Everybody thinks you are a little bit shady or something like that, and nobody trusts you, and you don't trust anybody. When people start to trust me, I start to doing better things for me, for myself.
Critics say the current economic crisis and resulting social misery could have been avoided if EU leaders had prevented the war in Ukraine through diplomacy. It has been suggested by some political commentators one way the EU could ease its growing homelessness crisis would be for Western nations to adopt a foreign policy that is less aggressive, which would avoid further displacement of millions of more people. Jerome Hughes at the European Economic and Social Committee, Brussels.
Delegations from the Caspian littoral states have gathered in the Russian capital to participate in the second Caspian Economic Forum. The event has become the largest platform in a post-pandemic period to discuss topics including cooperation among member states. Marina Kortunova reports from Moscow.
The second Caspian Economic Forum has been held in Moscow. During the event, issues including developing trade and economic cooperation, interaction in the field of ecology, energy, transport, and logistics were discussed. Delegations from the Caspian five littoral states, namely Russia, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Iran, and Azerbaijan, were present at the event.
The countries of the Caspian region will have to work in the current turbulent conditions of the global economy and geostrategic tensions. The West is putting increasing pressure on other countries in an attempt to maintain the existing world order.
The Caspian region possesses a significant part of the world's gas and oil reserves. It is of high significance, especially at a time when the whole world is facing an unprecedented energy crisis. The Iranian authorities came up with a new proposal to address those issues.
In order to unify and harmonize tariffs for rail, road and sea transportation, expanding trade and economic cooperation, we propose to establish a committee for cooperation in the field of transport, transit and customs business.
The Islamic Republic, given its geographical location, has very good opportunities to conduct operations in the oil and gas sector, as well as providing energy supplies to other regions. Iran has stressed the need to accelerate the unification of the country's electric power networks with those of the Caspian states.
The main purpose of this forum is boosting the economy of regional countries and to enable the Caspian states to use their opportunities to develop trade and economic cooperation, culture and tourism. Also, everyone should not only use the opportunities of the Caspian Sea, but also protect it. We are actively working in the development of the North-South Transport Corridor. The shipping lines of the Islamic Republic of Iran have allocated 300 containers for the transportation of goods to Russia.
Apart from what was said and proposed at the event, the forum also had good news for the member states. Cruise shipping on the Caspian Sea is set to begin in 2023 for the first time in history.
More than 1,000 delegates from the five Caspian Sea littoral states, as well as Belarus, Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, have taken part in the forum. In the meeting, the participants agreed to adopt decisions to enhance all-out cooperation among countries in the Caspian region. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
That's a wrap for this hour's World News. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
Experts are blaming big oil companies for climate change, and in particular, the recent Hurricane Ian, which caused destruction and suffering in the U.S. state of Florida. While oil executives are raking in astronomical profits, the issue of climate change and the tragedies it causes is out of the spotlight. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for the second part. According to Guardian, Hurricane Ian is no anomaly. The climate crisis is making storms more powerful. Climate change once seemed a distant threat, no more. We now know its face, and all too well. We see it in every hurricane, torrential rainstorm, flood, heat wave, wildfire, and drought. It's even detectable in our daily weather. Climate disruption has changed the background conditions in which all weather occurs. The oceans and air are warmer, there is more water vapor in the atmosphere, and sea levels are higher. Hurricane Ian is the latest example. Ian made landfall as one of the five most powerful hurricanes in recorded history to strike the U.S., and with its 150-mile-per-hour winds at landfall, it tied with 2004's Hurricane Charley as the strongest to ever hit the west coast of Florida. In isolation, that might seem like something we could dismiss as an anomaly or fluke, but it's not. It's part of a larger pattern of stronger hurricanes, typhoons, and superstorms that have emerged as the oceans continue to set record levels of warmth. Many of the storms of the past 5 years, including Harvey, Maria, Florence, Michael, Ida, and Ian, are a natural disaster so much as human-made disasters, whose amplified ferocity is fueled by the continued burning of fossil fuels and the increase in heat-trapping carbon pollution, a planet-warming greenhouse gas. This Atlantic hurricane season, although it started out slow, has heated up thanks to unusually warm ocean waters. Fiona hit Puerto Rico as a Category 1 hurricane, subsequently strengthening to powerful Category 4 storm, and hundreds of thousands of people that are still without power. The storm barreled on into the open Atlantic, eventually making landfall in the Maritime provinces to become Canada's strongest ever storm. Then came Ian, which feasted on a deep layer of every warm water in the Gulf of Mexico. Human-caused warming is not just heating the surface of the oceans. The warmth is diffusing down into the depth of the ocean, leading to year-after-year record ocean heat content. That means that storms are less likely to churn up colder waters from below, inhibiting one of the natural mechanisms that dampen strengthening. It also leads to the sort of rapid intensification we increasingly see with these storms, where they balloon into major hurricanes in a matter of hours. Too often we still hear, even from government scientists, the old saw that we cannot link individual hurricanes to climate change. There was a time when climate scientists believed to be true, but they don't anymore. We have developed powerful tools to attribute the degree to which global warming affects extreme events. One study found, for example, that the devastating flooding from Hurricane Florence as it made landfall in North Carolina 4 years ago was as much as 50% greater and 80 kilometers larger due to the warmer ocean. We can also draw upon basic physics, as we explained in Scientific American in 2017. Warmer oceans mean more fuel to strengthen hurricanes, with an average increase in wind speeds of major hurricanes of about 18 meters per hour for each of ocean surface warming, a roughly 13% increase. Since the power of the storm increases roughly the wind speed not only squared but raised to the third power, that amounts to a roughly 44% increase in the destructive potential of these storms. There is also evidence that human-caused warming is increasing the size of these storms. All else being equal, larger storms pile up greater amounts of water, leading to larger storm surges like the 12 to 18 feet estimated for Ian in some locations. Add sea level rise, and that's the better part of foot of additional coastal flooding baked into every single storm surge. If humanity continues to warm the planet and destabilize the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets, we could see yards, not feet, of eventual sea level rise. Think of that as a perpetual coastal flooding event. Then there is the flooding rainfall, like the 20 inches of it we are seeing across a large swath of Florida with Ian. Simple physics tells us that that amount of moisture that evaporates off the ocean into the atmosphere increases about 7% for each 1 degree Celsius of ocean surface warming. That means 7% more moisture to turn into flooding rains. But that's not the whole story. Stronger storms can entrain more moisture into them, a double whammy that produced the record flooding we saw in Philadelphia a year ago with Hurricane Ida, and the flooding we saw with Harvey in Texas in 2017 and Florence in Carolinas in 2018, the two worst flooding events on record in the U.S.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The blood on the wall and torn clothes, he would understand that a catastrophic event took place here.
Tonight, they became the gates to hell. Suicide bombings have claimed numerous lives.
ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attack there in Afghanistan.
August 26th, 2021, Kabul Airport. One of the deadliest terrorist attacks in Afghanistan. 169 Afghans lost their lives in a terrorist attack at two gates, Karzai International Airport. This attack exactly coincided with the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. This deadly attack is just one example of the massacres that terrorists committed in Afghanistan. This bloodbath will never end. America's Response Monument in New York City, a statue of an American soldier on horseback. Many people think that this statue is related to the American Civil Wars in the 19th century or to World War II, but surprisingly, it is related to the 21st century and the presence of American troops in Afghanistan.
And there's a picture of them on horseback.
But why U.S. Special Forces rode horses in Afghanistan? These soldiers were actually security forces from the CIA and the Pentagon, who, in the early days of the occupation of Afghanistan, were responsible for providing intelligence support to the Afghan proxy forces, along with carrying out airstrikes. He is Robert L. Grenier, the former director of the CIA Counterterrorism Center and author of 88 Days to Kandahar, a CIA diary. He believes that the U.S. proxy war against the Taliban started in 2001.
We quickly determined that the best way forward was for us to leverage relationships with Afghans on the ground who could do what we could not over the long term, and that is to deny their country. And because CIA had those relationships, people were looking to CIA to actually lead this effort. And so that put me in a very, very unique position.
Operational Detachment Alpha ODA 595, with the leadership of David Tyson, CIA's top agent. This group entered northern Afghanistan by helicopter from the Karshi-Khanabad K2 airbase. The mission of this group was to conduct unconventional warfare in support of an Afghan person named Abdul Rashid Dostum.
The real power base in northern Afghanistan is around Mazar-e-Sharif. And the man who controls that region is Abdul Rashid Dostum. The Americans showed up around October. So when an A-team goes in, they have a mission. And this one just said, support Dostum. You'd see Dostum with his turban, the warlord, and then you'd see these two guys wearing turbans and Oakley sunglasses sitting next to him, the CIA. So it's almost like the man who would be king, you know?
Finally, the CIA, with full support of proxy forces, captured the most important city in northern Afghanistan, Mazar-e-Sharif. It happened after a face-to-face battle. Same time in southern Afghanistan, Operational Detachment Alpha, the ODA 574, a group of 12 members, transferred another Afghan ally to Afghanistan by support of the CIA center in Pakistan. Team 574 entered Afghanistan from the south. This team, led by Jason, a Marine, supported Karzai. They wanted to occupy Kandahar, the last city under the control of the Taliban. Karzai led the tribes around Kandahar to rise up against the Taliban.
Support tribal leaders in the Pashtun south of Afghanistan who were willing to rise up against the Taliban. And we tried to turn Afghanistan, I would argue, into something that it was not.
Finally, the Americans captured Kandahar with Karzai's support. Karzai and Abdul Rashid Dostum were key figures in the first days of the U.S. invasion. The CIA continuously triggered proxy wars in Afghanistan after 2001. The all-out attacks of the Western countries and the capture of all Afghan cities made the Taliban forces retreat to remote mountains and villages. Mullah Muhammad Omar reorganized the Taliban. After a short period of retreat, he started the Taliban movement from a small school of thought in Singhasar, Kandahar. He gradually started small uprisings against the occupying forces. In 2006, the Taliban could retake control of significant parts of Afghanistan thanks to irregular warfare campaigns, a process that continued year after year. They thought about negotiations with some of Mullah Muhammad Omar's deputies after the failure of conventional wars against the Taliban and the increase in the West's military expenses.
The logic was, if you can't win the war militarily, then you'll have to win it through politics, through negotiations, through diplomacy, through some kind of political settlement. And year after year, military efforts were resourced over diplomatic and negotiating efforts. The book does describe a very fascinating secret negotiation between the Obama administration and the head of the Taliban's political commission at the time, Tayyip Aga.
The negotiations were conducted to change Mullah Muhammad Omar's mind, but they were fruitless.
An American invasion, we were hoping that that would cause Mullah Omar, the head of the Taliban, to change his mind. He did not change his mind. And so I worked very hard in two long meetings with his deputy to try to convince him to push Mullah Omar aside and do what his chief could not.
In this situation, it was expected the U.S. would adopt a new policy.
Today I signed a historic agreement between the United States and Afghanistan. We will complete our mission and end the war in Afghanistan. By the end of 2014, the Afghans will be fully responsible for the security of their country.
In this regard, Hamid Karzai and Barack Obama signed an agreement called the Strategic Partnership Agreement in 2012. The American forces handed over security responsibilities of Afghanistan to local security forces for 2 years. A small number of remaining American soldiers started training and supporting the Afghan army. December 28, 2014, NATO seemingly ended its military operations. Number of American troops in Afghanistan decreased a lot compared to the past. When NATO forces couldn't stop the Taliban, how could the Afghan army fight against them? But the West's plan to prevent the advance of the Taliban did not end here, because there was a more important issue on the table. In the process of peace negotiations, when the Afghan political delegation met with Pakistani and sometimes American officials, John Kerry provided Karzai with classified information about Mullah Muhammad Omar's whereabouts and movements. The American and Pakistani officials continue providing the classified information for Karzai during the years of peace negotiations. According to Asim Salim Bajwa, a former spokesman of the Pakistan Army, Karzai knew about Mullah Muhammad Omar's death during his visit to Pakistan in 2013. Of course, this news remained a secret until 2015 and the new government of Afghanistan under the presidency of Ashraf Ghani. On July 15, 2015, Abdul Hasib Sadegh, the former spokesman of Afghanistan's General Directorate of National Security, officially announced that Mullah Muhammad Omar died in a hospital in Karachi, Pakistan. But what was the motivation to keep it a secret? And on the other hand, to publish this news suddenly and publicly? This news was published exactly 1 day before talks between the Taliban and the government of Afghanistan. This action was defined based on the policy to control the Taliban. Michael Kugelman, the deputy director of the Asia program and senior associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center.
This will certainly impact peace talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government, because it'll be very difficult for the Taliban to focus on talks when it's going through a leadership crisis.
They thought the Taliban faced a leadership crisis, a and it could affect their unity in negotiations. And finally, the Taliban's advances in Afghanistan were also controlled after the collapse of negotiations.
Not to get fixated on a characterization of the Taliban that fits your own view of what you need to do. So if you are advocating a strategy of splintering and peeling away, you're going to naturally look for fissures in the organization and lack of cohesion in the organization.
Splintering the Taliban was the best way to weaken this organization. The announcement of the death of the founder of the Taliban gave an opportunity to the people who were previously expelled from the organization by Mullah Omar. Later, they were used to weaken the Taliban. Mullah Muhammad Omar had fired some Taliban leaders in the past due to violations of the rules. Mansur Dadullah was Mullah Dadullah's brother. Mullah Omar dismissed him from the Taliban organization because of his insubordination in negotiations with foreign parties and involvement in the assassination of Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. Mullah Muhammad Omar also dismissed Abdul Manan Niazi due to extensive financial corruption.
Since the death of Mullah Omar, we have seen the Taliban have become increasingly decentralized, both horizontally and vertically. They have also become relatively incoherent. They have also splintered across different factions and groups that are now operating under different flags and different leaders.
In this situation, the media added flame to the fire.
Mullah Omar, I mean, we've had reports that he might be dead many times before. What does it tell us, if indeed these reports are correct, that he has indeed been dead for 2 years?
On the flip side, people like General John F. Campbell, former commander of the Resolute Support Mission and United States Forces, Afghanistan, instilled doubt and ambiguity in the Afghan society.
You know, a couple weeks, middle of July time frame, when the announcement of Mullah Omar's death came out, you got to think to yourselves, you know, he's been dead for 2 years. Why didn't the regular Taliban know about that? Somebody that was deceiving everybody. I think what's happening right now is they're trying to figure out who is going to lead the Taliban. Is it Mansur? Is it Zakir? Is it Yaqub? Is it Manan?
And Amrullah Saleh, former head of the National Security Directorate, the NDS, of Afghanistan. In such a critical situation, the Taliban Supreme Council appointed Mullah Akhtar Mohammad Mansur as the new leader. Under the leadership of Mullah Akhtar Mohammad Mansur, some Taliban leaders reopened old wounds. Tayyip Aga was the head of the Taliban's political office in Doha, Qatar. Sayyid Mohammad Tayyip Aga resigned after Mullah Akhtar Mohammad Mansur came to power and left the world of politics. But not all the disaffected members of the Taliban took the same measures. In some cases, they used weapons and started wars. Mullah Muhammad Rasool's insurgency was the most important sign of the beginning of a war against the Taliban. In a strange way, the BBC covered this meeting that was held in the outskirts of Herat. On November 10th, 2015, Mullah Muhammad Rasool officially announced himself as leader of the Taliban in a big meeting in Herat. He could have many followers afterwards. Mullah Muhammad Rasool and his supporters basically didn't consider Mullah Akhtar Mansur to be the leader of the Taliban. Mullah Muhammad Rasool appointed Abdul Manan Niazi and Mansur Dadullah as the deputies of provinces in the west and south of Afghanistan. Mansur Dadullah entered into direct military conflict with the new leader, Mullah Akhtar Mansur. In 2015, Mansur Dadullah was killed in Zabul province in the conflict with the Taliban. Mullah Mansur Dadullah's death marked the end of the activities of rebel groups in southern Afghanistan. Mullah Akhtar Mansur's forces concentrated on Herat to destroy the western faction of the insurgent movements led by Abdul Manan Niazi. In 2016, Mullah Akhtar Mansour decided to put down the rebellion once and for all. But the U.S. directly intervened to defend Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi. In 2016, Mullah Akhtar Mansour, former leader of the Taliban, was assassinated in a U.S. drone strike. The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, in collaboration with the Afghan government, decided to kill him.
Mansour was a threat to that effort, and this action sends a clear message to the world that we will continue to stand with our Afghan partners.
The Taliban Central Council appointed Habibullah Akhundzada as the new leader after the assassination of Mullah Akhtar Mansour. Under the leadership of Hibatullah Akhundzada, the conflict between Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi and the Taliban continued. After 2016, Mullah Muhammad Rasul's forces had only one main and serious faction that was led by Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi in the provinces from the southwest to the northwest. In 5 to 6 years of his leadership, Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi was able to attract the loyalty of some of the Afghan tribes and fight against the Taliban. Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi called Akhundzada a mercenary and dependent person. He called the forces under the leadership of Mullah Hibatullah Akhundzada as fake Taliban supporters and soldiers of fortune. On the contrary, he called his organization the Supreme Council of the Taliban and considered himself as the true successor of Mullah Omar. He also considered himself as the future Amirul Mu'mineen of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. War with all of Afghanistan's neighbors does not match any political logic. He also criticized and complained about the countries of the region that were occupied by the U.S. or its allies. In this situation, he never criticized Saudi Arabia, Israel, or the Daesh terrorist group. But we don't know who exactly supported Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi. The New York Times, in an article published on June 19, 2017, explained in detail who exactly supported Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi. This article suggested the Afghan intelligence agency paid each member of this group salaries equivalent to $150 to $300 a month to fight against the Taliban and Afghanistan's neighbors.
The splinter Taliban groups from lower level commanders from the main movement, which you know would be the Afghan Taliban or the Quetta Shura, and from the battlefield, and slowly integrate them into the Afghan government, and this would bring or pressure the Taliban top leadership.
In the battlefield, when Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi's forces were under pressure, the Afghan army helped them and took the wounded soldiers to government hospitals for treatment. Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi had also mentioned his cooperation with the Afghan army. In fact, the secret cooperation between the Afghan government and Abdul Manan Niazi was a plan to weaken and destroy the Taliban. But this tragedy failed, and Mullah Manan Niazi was eventually killed in a clash with the Taliban in Herat. Although he claimed to be an invincible leader, his death broke the chain of this breakaway faction in western Afghanistan.
In the Limelight.
In the United States, the school district in Uvalde, Texas, has suspended its entire police force. The school district says activities have been halted for a period of time amid an investigation into the police response to last May's massacre at an elementary school in Uvalde. Please stay with us for the world media's coverage of this story. The British newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. The school district in Uvalde, Texas, suspended its entire police force on Friday, 7th of October, 5 months after a shooting in which 19 children and two teachers were killed, the district school said in a statement. The move followed a wave of outrage over the hiring of a former Texas state trooper who was part of the hesitant law enforcement response during the May shooting incident at the Robb Elementary School in Uvalde. School teachers also put two members of the district police department on administrative leave, one of whom chose to retire instead, according to a statement released by the Uvalde School District. The extraordinary move to suspend campus police operations 1 month into a new school year in the South Texas community underscored the sustained pressure that families of some of those killed on 24th of May have placed on the school district. Brett Cross, whose 10-year-old son, Uzziah Garcia, was among the victims, had been protesting outside the Uvalde School Administration building for the past 2 weeks, demanding accountability over police officers who allowed a gunman with an AR-15-style rifle to remain in a fourth-grade classroom for more than 70 minutes. "We did it," Brett Cross tweeted on Friday. The Texas state senator who represents Uvalde, Roland Gutierrez, issued a statement on Friday thanking Brett Cross and Cross's supporters for their persistence. "The Uvalde massacre shocked the conscience of our nation," Roland Gutierrez's statement added. "This cannot be the end. We still need full transparency and justice from every agency and every level of government that failed us in Uvalde." The district said it would ask the Texas Department of Public Safety, which already assigns dozens of troopers to the district, for additional help. "We are confident that the staff and student safety will not be compromised during this transition," the school district said. The school district is also reportedly considering retirement options for and a plan to transition from its superintendent, Hal Harrell. Hal Harrell was in his 31st year of education when the killings at Robb Elementary School unfolded last May. The move to suspend the Uvalde School District police force comes a day after revelations that the district not only hired a former trooper who was one of nearly 400 officers who rushed to Robb Elementary School on 24th of May, but that she was among the at least seven troopers later placed under internal investigation. Crimson Elizondo was fired on Thursday, just one day after CNN reported her hiring. She has not responded to voicemails and messages. ABC News tells us more about the same story. The Uvalde, Texas school district still facing withering criticism over its police department's failings, both during the 24th of May elementary school massacre and since, announced the suspension of the entire district police force on Friday. Hours later, Uvalde school district superintendent Hal Harrell announced he would be retiring. There was no time frame given for Hal Harrell's retirement, but the transition will be discussed in a closed session of the school board on Monday. The district said it's requested more Texas Department of Public Safety troopers to be stationed on campuses and at extracurricular activities amid the police department's suspension, adding, "We are confident that staff and student safety will not be compromised during this transition." The length of the school district police suspension is not clear. Lieutenant Miguel Hernandez, who was tasked with leading the department in the fallout from the shooting that killed 19 students and two teachers, and Ken Muller, the UCISD's Director of Student Services, were placed on administrative leave. Miguel Hernandez acknowledged in a law enforcement communication in August that he'd received formal notification from DPS that an officer applying to Uvalde's school police force was under investigation for her response at the Robb Elementary School last May. Ken Muller has elected to retire, according to the school district. Officers currently employed will fill other roles in the district, the school district said. According to the district's website, that includes four police officers and one security guard. Victims' families, led by Brett Cross, guardian of 10-year-old victim Uzziah Garcia, had been holding a round-the-clock vigil outside the school district headquarters, calling for change. The families are now commending Friday's police department announcement. "We've gotten a little bit of accountability," an emotional Brett Cross told ABC News. "So it's a win, and we don't get very many of those." Kimberly Rubio, whose daughter Lexi was killed at the Robb Elementary School, said the department's suspension was what we've been asking for. "It's more than we've been asking for. They don't know how to..."